Okay, everybody, this episode of the podcast is brought to you by Small World Coffee in Princeton, New Jersey. Now, before I go any further, this is a Concert Honesty podcast. The guy who sort of is the head honcho there at Small World Coffee is a guy named Vin. Vin's a badass. Vin is somebody who I think 10, 11 years ago when SOCI first started, Vin was one of the first people in Princeton who let us play in his venue. For better or worse, Vin, I'm sorry, but we took that place over and hopefully forced all of our students to buy coffee, so we made up for it. But we had a new venue, and for the last 10 years, we have been performing with our SOCI students in the sort of back seating area of the Witherspoon Street location of Small World Coffee in Princeton, New Jersey. Now, I got to confess something, Vin. I've had Rojo. I've had Starbucks. It was in a pinch, bud. I'm really sorry. I mean, and I'm not here to bash any other organization. I don't want to go negative. That's not what I'm talking about here, Vin. I just wanted to get it off my chest before we proceed here and you support this podcast, which I think it's fun. I enjoy doing it. I hope that the people that I'm talking to are interesting, and I hope you support that. But, Vin, I want you to know that my heart is with Small World Coffee. It's the place that So goes to meet if we're going to write in cues and scores, or during SOCI, students want to meet to talk about, you know, career advice or whatever. And hey, let's meet at Small World Coffee. Everybody knows where Small World Coffee is. And if you don't want to go to the Witherspoon one, you can go to the one on Nassau Street if that's easier for you. And they serve hot food there. Anyway, Vin, it's me and you now, buddy. And I'm pumped. Thanks a lot for getting behind the podcast. My wife is out of her mind with these beans, so thank you. And she's like, this may be the best pay that you've ever gotten for any gig you've ever done in your entire life. As she's grinding the coffee for tomorrow morning. So thanks, Vin. It does mean a lot to me. I genuinely do appreciate it. And I hope that I represent you well. And I hope I get a few more people in the door. Now, moving forward, if you want to learn more about Small World Coffee and you don't live in Princeton, New Jersey, if you live in Princeton, I'm pretty sure you know where it is. You can check them out at smallworldcoffee.com. You can find them on Twitter and Facebook as well. And I'll bet, I'm just going to put this out there, I'll bet if you go in there and you say, hey, I heard about Small World Coffee on the Concert Honesty podcast with Missy Mazzoli, I'll bet that that barista will give you an extra punch and a fist bump on your little punch card, get you a little closer to getting that free coffee just for taking a listen and dropping by Small World. They're good people there. They've been supporters of SOCI and So for as long as I've been in the organization. They make damn good coffee and roast it right there in Princeton. You can buy their coffee online. They'll ship it right to you. You can buy as much as you want. You want 18 bags, they'll ship you 18 bags. Easy. They make it as easy as possible. All right. Moving on, Missy Mazzoli. Missy is my guest today. Missy and I sit in her kitchen and talk about her life as a composer. We sort of reminisce on our college days as well a bit. You can check out Missy at missymazzoli.com. The opening track is a piece by Missy called Vesper Sparrow. It was written for the vocal ensemble Room Full of Teeth for their album called Render. It's about 5 minutes long, so once the track plays, if you want to skip ahead to the podcast, you can do that, but that would be silly because that piece is amazing and that ensemble is stunning, so you should check it out. The piece at the end of the podcast is a piece by Missy called Volume. It's a duo that was written for me and my friend Jamie Dietz. Jamie and I played in a duo together in grad school at Yale, and we also had the pleasure of playing in a Frank Zappa cover band in our final semester at Yale with Missy Mazzoli on keys and vocals, Jamie Dietz on drums and vocals, James Moore of Dither on guitar and vocals, Eleanor Oppenheim on bass and vocals, and myself on mallets, percussion, vegetables, and vocals. Let me just put this out there. Those were some of the best times of my life, and I'm going to say it's nice to have some secrets that the internet does not have. You know, YouTube cameras on phones were not a thing then, folks. So all of those concerts, God, but I remember them as clear as day. And sitting across at the end of the podcast, Missy and I make a joke about the Zappa cover band, and she just looks at me and she's like, she sort of holds back. And there's good reason, and it is hilarious. We had a good giggle afterwards. So anyway, Missy is one of my favorites. She's a good friend of mine from grad school, and we haven't seen each other in a while, to be clear. So we were catching up a little bit, but she is a beast. And that was clear playing with her in grad school, and sort of as I started working with So and her, seeing her work in New York and hearing her music get played and seeing her career sort of blow up recently. And then finally recently getting nominated for a Grammy. It's been really awesome to see that. And I got to hear her speak at the Young Women Composers Camp in Pennsylvania, run by Aaron Bush. And it was an amazing lecture that she gave. She answered the questions of these young students. Just, it was like sage advice from just a wise old soul from 1,000 years ago. It was amazing. And we hung out for a second afterwards. It was just great to catch up. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. I did, and I'm hoping to get to hang with Missy a bit more than I have been in the past. So anyway, enjoy. Again, this is the piece called Vesper Sparrow by the ensemble Room Full of Teeth, written by Missy Mazzoli. All right, enjoy. Oh. Missy Mazzoli.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks.
You're sitting in your beautiful kitchen.
Aww.
I'm really glad to talk to you. I saw you, when's the last time we crossed paths? Was it this summer?
Last summer in Philly.
At the New Jersey Young Women's Composers Camp.
It's not New Jersey. Young Women's Composers
Camp. Young Women's Composers Camp.
Pennsylvania.
Philadelphia. Aaron Bush, I'm so sorry. Yeah, why did I think?
And Jersey, please.
New Jersey, sorry, that's not. I'm gonna start over. No, I won't. You were giving a talk at the Young Women's Composers Camp,
mm-hmm.
and run by Aaron Bush,
mm-hmm.
and it reminded me how much we had hung out in grad school. We played in a Frank Zappa cover band,
Sears Ponchos.
Yes, we did, indeed. And I had sort of been following you on Facebook and sort of keeping tabs on your composer career, but. Then I saw you get nominated for a Grammy.
Oh,
and I was like,
I
went to school with, no, it didn't change everything, but I was like, oh my God, I went to school with somebody who got nominated for a Grammy. And anyway, it was great to hear you talk with the students. And I'm just curious, I realize also, I don't know a whole lot about where you're from. I know that we met in grad school at Yale, but
mm-hmm.
Past that, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? What got you into music and like, what do you do?
Yeah, good question. I grew up in Pennsylvania, which is why I have to defend Pennsylvania.
Please defend
from
away.
New Jersey.
Where in Pennsylvania?
Jersey. Outside of Philadelphia, suburbs, a town called Lansdale,
mm-hmm.
Which is a pretty small town. And I did not grow up, was not born into a musical family at all. I had a very supportive family, but no one was really artistic or musical. But I started playing piano at 7 and very quickly realized that I wanted a life in music, but that I was not going to be a famous pianist. I just didn't have the patience. I felt like I was not born into the right family. I just knew from a young age you had to enter into a sort of community that I was not in, you know, of like constant lessons and competitions. Yeah. And, you know, that wasn't me.
What did your parents do?
They're both retired special ed teachers now.
Oh, wow.
They're retired now. But yeah, they were special ed teachers. My sister's also a special ed teacher. And so I just started writing. I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do, you know? And, I also at the time had all these other interests, you know, I was interested in theater and poetry and, you know, wrote terrible poems for a long, long time. And like, would put on plays with my sister, I'd write plays and put them on with my sister, make movies and film them like with kids in the neighborhood.
I did that a lot. How old were you when you were making movies and stuff?
10, 11, 12.
Okay.
My
that was more
younger.
Like the dorky high school, like I had pimples and we were running around a Walmart parking lot, like making weird, like horror movies. It was pretty lame. There are moments when I'm really grateful that we didn't have the ability to just immediately upload them to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're all on VHS tapes in somebody's basement in Dover, Ohio that no one is ever going to see probably.
Right.
So
well, not yet.
Not yet. But. So you're 10 or 11 making movies and doing
theater.
Yeah,
just like doing shows, like making, I wanted to be in show business. And I wanted to make stuff, you know, and making stuff was the most important thing. And and I wanted something that would allow me to access all these other things I was interested in. And I couldn't find a creative way to do that through piano. It was too limited for me. And I think that great artists, great pianists do find that. Someone like Jeremy Dank has found a way to access a whole world through the piano. I couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and composing just fit. It was just a really... In some ways, like not a natural fit at all, because I was this like dorky girl in a small town in Pennsylvania, and you know, growing up in the 80s and 90s. But it temperamentally, it really worked.
What was the first piece you wrote? Like, I mean, that seems like a young age for anyone to be like, "Yeah, I'm going to be a composer." Composers were my voices at age 10 and 11. Like, what? How did you land on composing? Was there a piece? Did you meet a composer? Like.
No, I was really affected by classical music, and I can use the term classical in its like true sense, like Beethoven, Mozart. I mean, like all the hits, you know, I just loved that music so much. And it was just like, it just entranced me. Like I would like sit out in the backyard and listen to this music, you know, all the time. And just had this, it was like, it really had a power over me. And I thought, whatever these guys did, like, that's what I want to do. And someone was like, well, they're composers. I was like, well, I'm going to be a composer. And I think I started calling myself a composer before I'd even written anything.
Oh, wow.
Which is really weird. And that's not normal. But it was just kind of also just a way out. You know, I lived in this like tiny town where there was no culture. There was a certain kind of culture, you know, but there was not, it wasn't like a flourishing arts community at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up in a small town in Ohio, and the culture there, I mean, it's, you know, predominantly white town. I think there was like one Jewish family. I mean, I just assumed that was the makeup of the rest of the world. I mean, we didn't, I didn't have the internet. I had encyclopedias from 1983, like that stopped in 1983. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know.
It's just like Neptune is the furthest planet.
Right.
You're like, oh, okay. Yeah. Must be true.
Cool. You know? But I, for some reason, you know, my high school had a steel drum band. Mm-hmm. So all at once it was like this place that was not devoid of culture, but just a very specific type. And then this weird injection of like Caribbean culture in the middle of these cornfields in Dover, Ohio, that certainly changed my life. But, I mean, for you growing up in a small town, like what, was there a moment when you were in high school or like, when did you realize that like, okay, I need to decide, I need to do something. If I want to be a composer, I have to do X, Y, and Z. Like, did you have somebody guiding you through that process or was it all sort of self-driven?
I did. I mean, when I, you know, I'm sort of hard on Lansdale, Pennsylvania, because it's easy for me to describe it. It's like, it's a small town, there's no culture, but that's not true. You know, I had an amazing music teacher in high school. There was this whole like marching band culture, which is not what I did, but it was like access into the arts and music and playing in band and stuff. And I also at the same time was teaching tap dancing.
Oh, whoa.
And little kids. And one day when I was 15 doing this, and then one of my students heard father put up a sign in the dance studio that said piano lessons, drum lessons, composition lessons. And I was like, oh my God. And that changed my life. Like, and I was like, oh, this is something you can study. You can study how to write music. And so I started taking composition lessons from him. And he was the drummer, or the drummer, sorry. I don't know if that, is that a bad word?
No.
Okay, good.
It's an accurate word for someone who plays drums.
Yes, he was a percussionist. He did a lot more than play drums with the Philly Pops.
Oh, okay.
And so he would take me to rehearsals. And I was just like, these are my people. Like being in rehearsals, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. Like I'm supposed to be in a theater. And I would sit in the Academy of Music in Philly and just like sit in the audience while they were rehearsing and watch how they talked to each other and watch how it all came together. I was like, this is it. So he helped me put together a portfolio and then I got into college to study music.
Where did you... and forgive me if I ask any questions that seem obvious, but let's pretend nobody knows who either one of us is. were you looking at several different schools? I know like I get a lot of questions from students about like, where do I apply to school? Like, how did you, and my answer to them is terrible because I'm like, I don't know. I just applied at two places and I was really lucky that I got into Yale when I did. Otherwise I wasn't a very good planner on that front. I just got super lucky. But for you, how did you decide where you were going to apply? How was that process? Like, what did you submit? Did you have pieces that were written by that point that had been performed in high school?
Yeah. I mean, looking back, it all seems really crazy because it's like the biggest decision of your life. That's also the least informed. And now, yeah, I think now kids apply to like 10, 15 schools. And I remember, I think I applied to six. And I had no idea what to do. I knew I wanted to live in a big city because I didn't want to live in a small town anymore. And I knew, I felt like New York was too expensive. So that's how I landed in Boston. Okay. That's literally it. And also I knew I wanted to be in a big university, not just a conservatory.
Okay.
Because I had all these other interests and I felt like for a composer, it'd be good to be exposed to other people, like people who were doing, you know, majoring in journalism and visual art and communication. And those people, I went to Boston University, they became my closest friends and had a profound impact on my life. Like it wasn't so much the music department, even though that was great.
How so? It had a big impact on your life in what way?
Just in terms of like the way I look at the world. Like senior year of college, I lived in this like anarchist punk house in Alston, Massachusetts, like just outside the city or in like the north of Boston. And, people, these students, like my, all my housemates were like, journalism majors or, you know, I don't know quite what they did, but they, but they ran like a, this student underground, which is like this underground newspaper out of our house. Okay. And they were extremely political, you know? And so that really formed my worldview. And that was very important. And we were also going out to punk shows, going to, you know, galleries, going to see art. And it was just this opening into this world that I would not have gotten if I just stayed in the music school the whole time.
And is that something, the like political stuff, is that something, how had, did that specifically seep its way into your music? Like, give, or is it something that sort of has loosely been on the fringes while you're writing, or how do you deal with?
Well, I'm not an explicitly political composer, and that I don't use the language of politics in my work. I never found an effective way to do that. I mean, there are people, David T. Little, Ted Hearn, they're able to really, Frederick Jevsky, like they can do that in a very effective way. Like, and that's just not my language. I think now in my life, like that I'm speaking out on behalf of particularly women in music, my background with these people and like understanding how to communicate and speak in public like is very useful. So I think now in my life it's all sort of coming together. But you know, just it's important to, I felt it was important to be informed politically even if I wasn't doing music at all. You know, and these people were, these housemates were a way into that, which is really valuable.
I never had, I'm trying to think, like my mom was never very political growing. Were your parents at all? Like, did they talk about politics much?
No, they were like, we're going to vote Republicans because we don't want to pay taxes.
Right.
And then I remember in 2004, they were like, no, we're Democrats now. And I cried. I was so happy. Like, so I was like, that's the extent of our political discussion. I just repeated it all for you.
Right. I mean, my mom never, she was very much like, we don't talk about religion or politics because you're never going to change anybody's mind. And it just ends up heated and everybody gets mad. And my dad was like a Rush Limbaugh conservative. This was, you know, he died in 2009, but this was like when Rush Limbaugh was sort of like just coming on the scene, when talk radio was new, you know. We would get in these, I went to school, and it's like, because I went to a liberal arts school, and then I went to Yale and the East Coast, it was like, now I'm an East Coast elite, you know. And I'm just like, Dad, it's
just
me.
Instantly.
Like, it's like, it's me. Like, I've spent, you know, most of my life in Dover, Ohio, but just because I live on the East Coast now, I'm all of a sudden this crazy person. And we would just have these heated arguments, but I was never around, none of my friends were really political, even all the way up through grad school. It wasn't until I joined SO. Jason grew up, his sister is a, I don't want to use the word activist because I don't exactly know, she's very active in politics and advocating for certain things, but that was when it was like, I was around somebody for whom politics was super important, and it took me aback because I didn't quite know how to, like, I think that's why I'm not really good at dealing with it either in music or socially even, because I'm just awkward. Like, it just, I feel like I don't know how to say anything without being super heavy handed or, you know, just like awkward with it. And I try to, in general, just especially with music, like, I guess I try to, I'm backing away from it a little bit because these times right now are so crazy. You know,
that's an understatement.
If you make a statement in support or against anything, you're going to get this wall of, you know, criticism. But it's not a reason not to do it. But for me, I'm just like, it terrifies me.
It's not everyone's temperament. Right. Yeah, like I'm very reluctant to engage in online debates because there's no end to them.
No,
and I literally, it becomes a time thing. Like, you know, composing the projects that I'm doing and running this nonprofit Luna Lab, like the combination of all these things takes up my entire life.
Right.
And I'm not going to take time away from my students or my, like the young women in this program to debate with someone online.
Right. Or like, even time away from yourself.
Sure.
I mean, you know, that's valuable. And whether you spend that time reading a book or something, arguing with somebody who you can't see their eye contact, you can't see the look on their face when they say something. And most people would never say the stuff they say to someone's face.
Yeah.
You know, if you were just having this discussion.
I mean, I'm glad some people do have the stomach for it, like to engage in online debates, because I enjoy reading it, you know, to a certain extent, you know, and like there's definitely a place for that. but it is a personal choice
right.
for me. Like I engage yeah. in other ways. I just cannot participate in that aspect of it.
Yeah. I've never felt productive in those moments. I've never felt like I've ever moved the ball forward mm-hmm. in any real way with like online debates. It's like in person or with projects that we do, it's like, I feel more, or even just like a one-on-one thing that nobody knows about, like mm-hmm. donating something or giving money to a project or helping somebody. Like I've never felt like I've helped anybody with an online argument about something, yeah. but, that's neither here nor there. So after Boston, mm-hmm. You ended up going to Yale.
I had a 2-year detour in Amsterdam.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Amsterdam?
I got a Fulbright grant to go there. Again, it was like a series of very small decisions that led to a big decision. Like mm-hmm. I didn't want to go to grad school right away. I wanted to try to travel and go mm-hmm. to Europe. And I applied for a Fulbright. And I wanted to go to the Netherlands to work with Louis Andriessen, mm. and also because the language of the program was English.
Got it.
My German was so bad. Mm. I thought about trying to go to Germany. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. Ended up in Amsterdam, and it was really one of the best decisions I've ever made. And I spent 2 years there studying in The Hague at mm. the conservatory there, which was at the time, really this melting pot of amazing compositional voices. Mm-hmm. I mean... obviously, you know, we had the influence of like our Dutch teachers, but there are tons of students from South America, mm. England, all over Europe, a few like wild-eyed Americans who had somehow ended up there for some weird reason.
Anybody else that I would know?
Americans, Nathan Michelle went there, Emily Doolittle, they were there a little bit before me. Okay. Molly Joyce.
Mm-hmm. Molly was at SOCI a few years ago.
Yeah.
She's great.
She's wonderful. Yeah. And she went there after me, mm-hmm. years after me. So it's an amazing place to be. And after that, but I thought about trying to stay there forever, you know, because healthcare, support for the arts. Like,
Bicycles.
Why would I leave?
Tulips.
But America's definitely my country. And I missed the sort of grassroots... and maybe this is influenced by this political background in college, but mm-hmm. The sort of building something from the ground up,
yeah.
building ensembles, building organizations, building nonprofits, just building this and, you know, building a record label, all these things doesn't happen as much in the Netherlands because there's more support. So there's more of a structure for it there. Why would you build something yourself?
That's been ever since I joined SIL and became aware of government funding and, mm-hmm. you know, knowing what the NEA does and how little it's funded and the arguments around, everything's better in Italy because you can get a grant for whatever, or Canada.
Not Italy.
Well, I mean, this was 13 years ago. It was we went on a tour in Italy and it was funded by some organization there, whatever. But I think I had a similar thing where I personally really, and I hate the word pull yourself up by your bootstraps because I think that's a terrible phrase because a lot of people don't have boots, let alone straps. But there is something to the when you wake up and you have zero money and the only way you're going to get money is if you do it. Mm-hmm. There is something to the cream in some respects does rise to the top. It's the people who get up every day and toil away and mm-hmm. work and who just keep butting their head against that wall and don't give up mm-hmm. that usually come to the surface and succeed, like starting something from the ground up. There's something organic to it in America that I'm curious if the NEA all of a sudden got $5 billion, like mm-hmm. a wall might get, how much would that change? I'm curious just as a thought experiment, mm-hmm. what would it change for the better? And what would it actually, would there be any negative side effects of a ton of money in the arts? And I'm not advocating, I'm just saying, I'm curious what that would actually mean.
I'm trying to think of a negative side effect of a ton of money in the arts. No, I do think there's things that are so baked into these cultures, like mm-hmm. the idea of philanthropy and donating and cultivating a base of donors, you mm-hmm. know, all these sort of strange things that we do in America, is just baked into our DNA as artists for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. It just is. And then in the place like the Netherlands, which is now moving away from public funding towards more private funding, I think they're having a hard time getting their heads around this new reality.
Right.
The idea that you'd have to go up and ask somebody for money, the idea that you'd spend 30% of your time mm-hmm. out there trying to raise money and having benefits and dinners and fundraising letters. It's just like, if you haven't done it, it's very hard to get into that zone.
Right.
So I think even if there was a ton of money, we'd still, that was just it magically appeared for the arts, like we'd still have that sort of go-getter DIY attitude as Americans. Like there's something about that that's sort of baked into the culture.
Yeah.
Which is good. I mean, that's not, I'm not, you know, like that's, there's aspects of that that are good, that are, that's why I moved back to America, mm-hmm. is because there's this excitement and this hunger around the arts, that is so exciting in our community.
Yeah. I think every day I wake up, I ask myself that same question. Like, I wonder if, like, yes, of course, when Eric emails and says, I got a grant, I'm like, yay, you know, it's not free money. There was work that had to go in to get it and all that stuff. And we're putting it to a good use. But if we just automatically every year, because we were an arts organization, got X amount of dollars from the U.S. government, over time, you know, you start to rely on that stuff. And then when a new government comes, like the Kremata, the percussion group, I don't think they exist in the same sort of situation that they used to, because there was a more conservative government that came into power in Sweden, cut a lot of the funding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when times are good, times are good. When times aren't good, times really aren't good if you're not used to that sort of ebb and flow. In the United States, it just feels like when the economy, like in 2007, when the economy crashed, I was sitting on the GW bridge when Lehman Brothers folded, that day that like people were walking out of the buildings with their like suit and ties and their boxes. Stock market had hit like 6K and everybody was freaking out. And I was sitting on the George Washington Bridge or the Queensboro Bridge going to rehearsal. And I just thought to myself, welcome to the club, everybody. I mean, come on in. The water is freezing.
Yeah. Water sucks.
Yeah. Nobody, you guys are upset because you don't have, you're getting your $10 million bonuses. But like most of us, at least in the arts, wake up every day. We don't have a paycheck unless we get up and do it. And so in some sense, like we were a little too small to fail. I mean, if you can sort of navigate those waters, you squirt out the other end and you're, you have tools, you know, and I think that's something about being in America, especially this, the gig economy, that word or whatever, you kind of have to hone your tools a little more frequently than if there was just funding coming in all the time.
You do. And it's hard. Like I remember getting into a bunch of debates in Europe. I was giving a keynote address at this opera conference in Copenhagen and, there were a lot of, you know, I had a hard time even myself wrapping my head around it when I had to explain our situation to non-Americans. Mm-hmm. So I was describing the process of putting together this opera, my second opera, Breaking the Waves, which is a massive 2.5 hour work for like chorus, principals, everybody, and 17 piece orchestra, that we did at Opera Philadelphia. And we had to stage the whole thing in 13 days, which is like no time at all. I was talking to these...
My heart's racing just thinking about that.
I know. No, me too. And like, even though it worked, it was like down to the wire.
Yeah.
And that was far from ideal, but we also went into it accepting that that was our reality.
Yeah.
And that inevitably affects how you work and how I write. You know, and I had to... So the Europeans were like, well, you're censoring yourself. You're simplifying your language to accommodate the economy. And I was like, no, it's not that at all. Like, I don't feel... But it's something that's hard to explain. Like, yes, like the circumstances of rehearsals and the reality of our situation does affect the art, but I don't feel like I'm compromising.
Yeah.
And getting them to understand that was hard. Getting myself to understand it is hard. Right. Does that make any sense?
Totally. I mean, as you were saying that, have you seen the new Queen movie
with Remy Ma? I haven't, because I love Queen so much that I haven't been emotionally ready to watch it.
Oh, well, I grew up on Queen, and I will assume that you love them more than I do, but I'm a huge Freddie Mercury fan. And
that's my first love.
It's such a good movie, and Rami Malek is just stunningly awesome in it. And they reenact the whole Wembley the Live Aid concert like to the step. I went and watched the real one afterwards, and I was like, oh. It's like where the Coca-Colas were sitting on the piano is like the exact, like the, it's,
I get chills.
It's so awesome. It's so good. But there's the part in the movie towards the end, like where they, I think like a year or two before Live Aid happened or something, like they all broke up because Freddie wanted to do a solo record, and you know, Brian May went and did his own solo record, and the drummer did too. And they all sucked. They were terrible. They all tanked. And they got back together. One of the things that Freddie Mercury says is, it turns out I need you guys. Like, my decadence, I need censorship. I need somebody to say, you need to rein this in. This is all just fudge. You're just puking out compositional fudge all the time. And yeah, it's awesome. You're not filtering anything, but you're not filtering anything. There's a lot of crap out here. And so when you listen to those Freddie Mercury solo albums, it is just like Bach, you know, like flipped, switched on Bach, like that sort of like synthesizer. Yeah. Like, it's just like, whoa, what's happening? But I think filtering is important. I think getting in a room, having a sort of clock ticking, telling you like, you got to make a decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's studies done that say that like you make better decisions when you have to pee. Because you're not just, your mind isn't wandering. You're very focused because you make more efficient decisions that way. But I think the compositional process, and I'm not like a composer in the way that you are. And I think this brings me to my next question. Like, in your compositional process, when do you keep the filter in the sort of drawer, and how does your process flow from beginning to end? Let's assume that you've got 2 months to write a piece or whatever. Like, how do you begin? I mean, for composers out there, I remember one of the pieces of advice I think you gave to the Young Women's Composer Camp was just, you got to start.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, there's no pill to take to get a piece written. You just make the first note and then throw it out if it's bad and make another note and whatever, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's the hardest thing and the simplest thing is to start. You know, I think, Meredith Monk, one of my idols, you know, describes this when she's starting a new piece, sometimes she'll find herself just shaking with fear. And I think looking at the blank page is terrifying. So starting, like I said, it's easy to say, just start. But that's, I also respect how hard that is for most artists out there. And Thea Musgrave, another amazing composer, describes, sometimes she says that she just like scribbles on the staff paper just to have something there.
Yeah.
So that it's not blank. There's a scribble there.
Yeah.
But for me, starting is hard. And it is like, it's like eating your vegetables. You just have to force yourself to do it. And then it gets easier and easier, you know, as the writing goes on. And I'll just start, but just like, like brainstorming super free, no filter at all, you know? And then when I hit upon something that I know is good or that I feel might be turn into something good is a more accurate way to say it. Then I can just feel it in my body and I'm like, okay, let me look at that idea. Okay. What about that idea is interesting. Okay. Let me look at that again. And it's really just this refine. And then, you know, the whole, the moment before I have to hand in a piece to people who are actually going to play it or like to just submit an opera or something, then all the practical considerations come in.
Right.
Then that's when you think about like, okay, we live in America and there's like, you know, 1/100th of the budget. This piece has 1/100th of the budget that it would have if it were in Norway or something or Sweden. And that's cool. I just got to figure out how to make this work despite that, you know? And so then it's like, how do you make what do the parts look like? Like, how's everything structured? How do these parts interlock? Like, there's usually a million ways to make a certain texture in music and, there's a complicated way and an easy way. And do I need this to be that complicated there? Can I afford to spend 20 minutes of rehearsal time on this measure? Sometimes the answer is yes. And sometimes the answer is just no. I got to simplify this and I'll still get the same effect.
Yeah.
So I don't see that as compromise.
No, I wouldn't say it is either. I mean, how do you compromise with yourself when you come up against something that you think is not good, but you can't figure out how to make it not good or not good?
Like not good.
Yeah. Like
good to make it good.
Or just like you, there's some block or something you're stuck on. How do you get unstuck?
I think just put it down, address it the next day. I think your brain solves a lot of problems for you while you sleep or while you're thinking about something else. You hear things differently when you go back to it. Just try to, and then another approach is just like make radical decisions. You know, what if this literally, what's the upside down version of this? What's the inversion of that? Like, try something really out there that forces you to look at it in a different way.
Yeah. Have you used the oblique strategies?
Yes.
The Brian Eno stuff. Jeremy Malvin, this kid that rents some space out of our studio, he has the box, like the cards. Mm-hmm. I think there's an online like random generator of them.
Yeah,
now,
I use the online one. Yeah,
yeah. He's got this box of cards, and it's like put the tambourine on the verse, you know, or right. or something like things you would never do. Just like flip it on its head and see if that gets you out of the mm-hmm. jam. And is your writing for? So you have a group Victoire mm-hmm. as well, and talk about that group for a second. Who's in it? Why'd you form it? When did you formed it? After grad school or while you were in?
After grad school. Yeah. Okay. Victoire is it's an ensemble band that mm-hmm. plays my music. Like I write all the music for it. And it's six women. So Olivia DiPrato on violin, Eileen Mack on clarinet, myself and Lorna Creer on keyboards, Eleanor Oppenheim on double bass, and Melissa Hughes singing. Mm-hmm. Fellow Yale-y grad school mm-hmm. friend of ours.
Was she in the Zappa band?
No, I don't think we could get her to be in the Zappa band.
I think she was smarter than we were.
Yeah.
She had higher standards.
No, I remember it was me and Eleanor singing in that Zappa band.
Right, and James.
James, yeah, of course. I started Victoire like a year after I moved to New York, and I wanted to have, just out of a desire to have more control over my music. So this was like 2007. This is like a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't like rolling in the gigs, you know, I was just like, okay, if I want to get my music out there, I'm going to have to like just make it happen. Yeah. And I loved the virtuosity of classical music or whatever we're doing, contemporary music. Mm-hmm. But I also loved the format of having a band, like, you know, we're friends with the guys in the National and like mm-hmm. all these people had these bands that were touring, they were making records, they were playing shows, they were doing all the things I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to create something that was this hybrid. It was the best of both worlds, mm-hmm. a hybrid of a band and a really virtuosic classical ensemble. We've been together for a long time. We're not doing so much lately because I've been so consumed with opera and I found mm-hmm. that it was sort of like one or the other. Uh-huh. And had to sacrifice a lot for the opera stuff, but it was a really important part of my musical life.
And when you were writing music, was it collaborative or did you bring in scores and then it was like they played all the parts?
It was...
As you wrote them.
It was both. I mean, it was mostly me bringing in written music. But I would leave a lot of it up to... Or they'd leave certain, like 10% of it up to chance or to... Not to chance, but to them to improvise or to give feedback on.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. And then Lorna Creer did a lot of like electronic remixes of our stuff too.
Oh, all right.
Which is really nice. Yeah.
When you are looking for, like, do you ever have a spot? Do you ever have a time when you don't have a commission on your plate at this point? Or is it you're like backed up now?
I'm like so backed up right now.
And how do you deal with, I mean, how, we were just in Toronto and Terry Riley was doing a show the night before ours. And then he came to our show on Saturday mm-hmm. and he was telling Jason the story, but he's just like, you know, whatever, he's Terry Riley and he's in his 80s now. So it's like, maybe he's earned the right to do this. But he's like, I just write pieces I want to write. And then I go and ask people if they want to commission those pieces.
Wow.
And you know, I think he's probably in that phase of his life where he can do that. Mm-hmm. But how do you deal with when you've got all these things on your plate? And what if there's an idea that strikes you and you're like, oh my God, I want to write a piece for violin and cimbalum or whatever it is. Like,
yeah.
How do you plot out your life, your creative life versus
this
business part, business side of it?
Well, I'm really, I feel like I'm really lucky in that I've managed to, you know, trick people into commissioning me for the things I want to write.
How do you do that?
Yeah, it just took a lot of time, you know, like, and so everything that is coming up in terms of commissions, I'm super excited about, mm-hmm. you know, like I'm writing this opera for National Opera of, Norwegian National Opera and Opera Philadelphia, mm-hmm. I can't talk about the subject yet, but it's really excited. I'm really excited about it. And then I'm writing an opera for the Met that is an adaptation of the George Saunders book, Lincoln and the Bardo.
I just read that book.
Isn't it good?
That book is incredible.
It's so good.
I love George Saunders.
I love him.
10th of December. You met him?
We met for lunch, and I almost had a heart attack.
And you didn't tell me you were meeting him. Otherwise, I would have creeped on another table next to him, overheard.
That'd be so funny.
He's amazing. 10th of December. The best. Have you read, what books of his have you read?
Oh my God. All of them. Brain Dead Megaphone, 10th of December, Civil War Land and Bad Decline.
In Persuasion Nation.
I mean, just.
I think he's probably one of the, if not the greatest, like at least living American storyteller, like storyteller, like weird surrealist, like these weird dystopian worlds that he creates that are, I don't know. They're so good.
Yeah. He's so original. Like there's just no one. Maybe there are, but I don't know of any other writer who's writing like that.
When is the Lincoln and the Bardo opera coming out?
Will go to the Met in like circa 2024.
Can you put me on the comp list for 2024?
Yes.
I would love to.
You're at the top of the list.
Great. That's awesome.
So those are things that I'm dying to do. Yeah. So like my creative energy is going into them. Mm. I'm not just like, it sounds weird. I'm not just like sitting around thinking of other things I want to do because those things take just all of my time and energy. Yeah.
What wrote a piece. Are you primarily focusing on opera or, I mean, you've mentioned like that's, have you found that that's where your compositional voice is sort of naturally finding a home? Mm-hmm. I mean, you wrote a piece for me and Jamie Dietz when we were in school called Volume that's being played, I think, twice at NYU this semester.
Oh, cool.
And it's really fun to get in and coach that piece again. Brings back some good memories.
Yeah.
Opera is where you're finding like a home, or is it like, where do you find your compositional voice sort of blossoming or blooming? Is there a particular genre or is...
Well, I do love opera. I love writing opera because the, you know, it just sort of like checks all the boxes for me. Like it's like, it's collaborative, it's theatrical. You're working with all these people from different disciplines. Mm-hmm. So directors, set designers, costume designers, librettists, writers, storytellers, like it's a community and it's like a family versus the experience of writing, let's say for an orchestra, where I write a piece for an orchestra, I go in, I have two rehearsals with them. I don't talk to anybody. I barely talk to anybody. Conductor maybe doesn't want to be there. Like, it can be a very isolating situation. And opera is the opposite. Opera is a community and everyone's so invested because everything has to be memorized. Like, it's really cool.
And there's a set.
And you're telling stories. Right. And I choose to tell stories about our life in America now is something that I'm really obsessed with, with the last opera and even with Breaking the Waves, which was not set in America, it was set in Scotland in the 70s, but it's sort of the story of a woman in an impossible situation who has everyone is surrounding her and telling her what to do. So I'm able to express those sorts of ideas through the art in a more direct way than like writing a string quartet.
Mm.
So it's just opened up my world and I got to have lunch with George Saunders because I'm writing opera and I got to meet the writer Karen Russell, who wrote the story that my last opera was based on. And I'm in dialogue with like Lars von Trier. And, so opera is just, it's really opened up my world. The only bummer is that they take so long to write and it's just like, oh my God, like it takes so long and it's so hard.
Is it long because in general operas have tended to be long? I mean, it's like when I think of write a string or a chamber music piece, like in my head, what comes to mind is anywhere between 10 and 25 minutes long, like just on average.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if somebody said write an opera, I immediately, my head goes to like Handel and Rodelinda, and it's like, well, it could either be 6 hours long or it could be somewhere in like an hour and a half, like, or whatever. Yeah. But that's still like,
you're sort of, hour and a half.
You're committed to a chunk of time that is just by default a heavier lift than, in terms of the amount of notes you've got to write.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, they're usually longer. Singing anything stretches it in terms of the time it takes versus speaking it.
And you're writing in English?
Yes.
How do you talk to me about writing for opera in English? Because I haven't heard the operas you've written, so excuse me, but people singing operatic stuff in English can be really rough if it's not done well. I mean, English is a weird language compared to like Italian or French or German, even though it's a little more glottal and hard. Mm-hmm. Somehow, you know, Wagner did his, you know, English to me doesn't feel like an operatic language, but tell me why.
Is that because you speak it?
Maybe. And to be clear, I'm ignorant of opera. And I mean, I think like Robert Ashley comes to mind as someone I think does a good job. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say
mostly spoken though.
Spoken, right? Or like spoke sung, mm-hmm. but I feel like he does a good job dealing with English as a language, mm-hmm. in that context. But for you, like what are some of the issues that have come up for you? And I'm asking just because I'm ignorant of it. I've never done it. No. And I don't know a whole lot about it.
Well, I think the trickiest part is in that, you know, in America, English is the language that most people speak. Mm-hmm. And so it's the language of everyday things. It's, mm-hmm. it's the language of I'm going to go to the grocery store, and to sing that feels really silly. Mm-hmm. My take on that is like, opera by default is like such a surreal art form. Like when you have people singing their thoughts, mm-hmm. we're not in reality anymore. Mm-hmm. And even if you're in a more or less realistic situation, there's something heightened about it. So I try to like lean into that. Mm. And if someone's singing, I'm going to go to the grocery store, really they're going to go to the grocery store because they're going to steal all the eggs and put them in their lover's mailbox. You know, I don't know, something bizarre, sure. Because yeah. This is their expression of love. Cause they're weird. I don't know. Like, mm-hmm. The idea that they're going to go and steal all the eggs is like in that singing, mm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's like, opera's superpower is subtext and like what's going on underneath the words. Mm. And I think if you can illuminate that, then the English becomes less weird. Or maybe more weird, but less awkward.
Have you written anything in another language?
No. And no. I mean, parts of my first opera were in French because the character was Swiss.
Okay.
But no, not really.
Do you have any hopes to at some point?
Like, no, I mean, I want to be, I'm very like solid in my identity as like an American artist in 2019, you know, and I want to write operas for, I wouldn't say just for an American audience because I would kill to have an opera in Europe, you know, but I'm an American, you know, and I want to write from that perspective and to touch upon things that affect Americans. Like my last opera was about the American dream. I'm working mm-hmm. on this piece about cults, you know, like these are sort of like particularly American obsessions. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine ever writing an opera in another language because that would feel like I was putting on a sort of costume.
Right. Especially if you don't speak.
Yeah.
That language.
That's the other problem. It's
actually, like, I can write French words down, but that doesn't
your problem.
Well, you, it's come up several times in our conversation. You as an advocate for women in the arts, mm-hmm. especially in composition. I mean, this is unfortunately a new conversation. It's very prominent now because mm-hmm. It's unfortunately new that people are talking about it yeah. in the way that they are. I mean, when I've known you since grad school, when we played in that cover band, and I feel like a dummy because it's like, I never looked at you or Eleanor or anybody or Jamie I never looked at Jamie as like a gay percussionist.
Mm-hmm.
It's Jamie.
Yeah.
And you're Missy. And that's Eleanor. And we play in a grand, and I play your piece and whatever. Like that was never an issue for me. And it's because I never have to think about it. It never crosses my mind because it never crosses anybody else's mind that I'm a guy, and that's just a thing I never think about. You know, what is it? How are you navigating that world, and how do you see your role in that world now that you are? I mean, when I've seen you talking, those girls at the camp this summer just were like eating out of the palm of your hand, and rightfully so.
They were amazing, yeah,
and rightfully so because you're doing. Like you're now in residence in Chicago, is that mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah, Chicago Symphony.
And you're nominated for a Grammy. Like nobody's ever done. It's not like you're finished and you can just like retire. But
that'd be amazing.
But
just kidding.
You definitely mm-hmm. you've carved a path. So how do you see your role in now that you're mm-hmm. on this other side of the coin? How do you see your role in today's sort of society and the way things are going?
Yeah. Well, I do. Yeah. I mean, I felt this my whole life. Like, I remember being in college, like being a freshman, sophomore in college, studying composition. I was the only female undergrad in the whole of Boston University who was really? Studying composition. Like,
how many majors were there?
There were probably like 30, 35.
So you were one out of like 30.
Yeah. And then eventually, like, there were two more that came by the end of my time there.
Okay.
But I was like, what is going on? You know, and I said to myself, like, my goal, if this ever works out for me, is to, number one, make it easier for women who come after me, you know, and to navigate this. Mm-hmm. And number two, to figure out why this happens. And so this trend continued. Like, I was, you know, eventually started teaching doing guest teaching in universities. I'm a professor at Manus now. Mm-hmm. I taught at NYU for a while. Like, and every class was the same. Like, I never saw a freshman class that had an equal gender balance. It was always like a class of 30 dudes and like one or two young women. Mm-hmm. And I would ask the professors where I would visit, like, why do you think this happens? And they're like, well, the women just don't apply. And I believe them. Like, I don't think that they're lying to me and like taking all the women's applications and like putting them in the trash.
Right.
I don't think that's happening. So I was like, okay, so that tells me something is happening to young women in that crucial age when you decide to be a musician. I think most of us decided to be a musician when we were like 14, 15, 16.
That's right.
You know, is when it like solidifies in your mind. And if you at that age hate yourself, or if you aren't, there are no role models, or if you feel you're discouraged from doing it, mm-hmm. you're not going to do it. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try to, one of my goals, one of my purposes in life is to like try to address the gender imbalance at that age and to encourage young teenage girls to pursue a life in music, which is why I think the camp that we both spoke at was so important. That's why I started this organization, Luna Lab, which provides mentorship to young female composers in their teens. So I think that that's my role. I think my role is to draw attention to things, very concrete things that organizations and individuals can do to address this, and to serve as a role model myself.
Yeah.
And also, you know what? Like, the other thing is like, I mean, it's interesting. Like, yeah, I don't think that most of the people we were in grad school with saw me as like a female composer, and certainly not anyone I would ever want to work with. Those, you know, saw me right. like that. We were all just friends. We were a community right. of musicians.
Right.
But it is shocking how you get outside of that and you realize that not everyone thinks that way. It's truly shocking. And when I'm like, when I got this position with Chicago Symphony, I've been doing curating of their chamber series, mm-hmm. the Music Now series. And I was like, oh wow, it is so easy to program women. You just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no secret here. Yeah. And my programming there is 60% female, mm-hmm. At least
yeah.
every season. It's so easy. There's so many women. yeah. So yeah, I'm flabbergasted too. It's like, I don't understand why this continues, but I think that these are concrete things I can do.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience with the Young Women's Composers Camp
mm-hmm.
in Pennsylvania?
Yes.
You spent more time with them, I think, than I did. Can you tell a little bit? The woman's name is Erin Bush.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience at that camp and sort of what they're doing? I think it definitely is in line with what you were. They were all women in that crucial time period, I think, mm-hmm. of what you sort of pinpointed a second ago.
Yeah. Well, I think I was only also there. I was just there for a day as well.
Oh, I thought you were staying like an extra. I thought you were there for 2 days. I misunderstood.
No. Yeah, and I was just there for a day, but it was. It was amazing. I think that, again, like it's not rocket science. I think that the simple act of bringing together young women who are writing music, getting them all in one room, and then sitting them in front of older women who are writing music, mm-hmm. like this is the key. That alone, if I had done that for one day of my childhood, my life would have been so much easier.
Those sitting in that room, well, first of all, watching them look at you like they, I mean, I'm sure some of them looked up to you and like idolized you in a certain way. Idolized is maybe certainly the wrong word. That feels like weird, but I like they were all looking and it was just sort of like, Oh, like mm-hmm. You're what, 36, 5, something like
that? 38.
Thank you're 38. You, but you're not old, mm-hmm. but you're in your clothes. They look at you and they're like, well, this isn't, I'm not reading this in a book. This is a real person in front mm-hmm. of me. Like, this is definitely doable. And then coming to SOCI and seeing, they came, I think, the next week and visited SOCI and seeing all of the composers there, the students at Princeton, also the attendees. Mm-hmm. I think you hit the nail on the head when you say that, like, yes, there's real oppression. Mm-hmm. There are people in institutions right now actively keeping people out mm-hmm. or discriminating against. But I think the best way to, like, really just kick down the sort of the wall is to start when they're young. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they're in fifth grade. I mean, when you think about, like, why are there not a lot of women in percussion? Well, I can tell you why there weren't a lot in my fifth grade class. And it's not because people were, you know, wanted to exclude women. It was like, well, there's a gymnasium full of every instrument. Mm-hmm. The snare drum and the tuba are the two heaviest things. So when we're in the room, like, everybody goes around, you pick up the things, and it's like, well, we're all herded into where physically you were the most fit to your instrument. So
wow.
The bigger boys played tuba. Mm-hmm. Or tall kids played tuba. The kids with the long arms played trombone. Like, I yeah. was a fairly, like, stocky-ish kid, like, strong. I could carry my... And that thing was so heavy. Like, mm-hmm. and I could bear... I had a little cart. I had to carry it around. I pulled it around in. And it's like, well, if we could just figure out... Like, if we just made drums... Like, it's not like you need an amazing drum when you're in fifth grade. You need something that sounds good, and then you can upgrade later. If we made mm-hmm. drums just lighter... Or
if you used a cart, like, could we also get some carts?
Right. And then put I'm just thinking of something like, this isn't rocket yeah. science. And so I grew up fairly stereotypical upbringing. Everybody in my, there was one or two girls in my entire drum line. They played mm-hmm. cymbals, mm-hmm. of course. They didn't play any of the drums because they were too heavy or whatever. It was mm-hmm. just like, but that's the way it was. It didn't feel in the moment. We were like, no. This is a guy's only thing. It was yeah. just this weird, dumb, like, circumstance of, like, these tiny little decisions way early on that sort of radiate out through the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And if we could get that gender balance early, mm-hmm. problem is it takes 10 or 15 years for that to actually show up
right.
down the line. And people aren't patient for that. But I think they should be, because that's where I think this whole mm-hmm. thing is going to, I don't want to say fix itself, but... A lot of the things we're seeing right now, I think, will be less drastic in 15 or 20 years if we can get to them early on.
Yeah. I think that change can happen very fast. I mean, I'm seeing, like, with the young women I mentor in Luna Lab, mm-hmm. I wrote most of them college recommendations.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, like, I'd help them figure out where to apply, you know? So even, like, in 1 year,
yeah.
you know, I'm seeing they're, like, they have me to turn to for advice. And I've been doing this for so long. You know, it's like, I have things to say about it and opinions. And I know everyone at every department. Like, I can tell them who I think would be a good fit.
Yeah.
So, again, like, just having one person like that can be huge. But I think back to what you were saying about the weight of the drums. Like, I think it's our responsibility to understand why these things happen and mm-hmm. to look at them. And to, like, if you look at a drum line and there's only two women... Not to be like, that's the way it is, but as you did, like, to look at it and say, like, why does this happen? Mm-hmm. Like, let's calmly look at why this happens.
Right.
And let's fix it, you know? Mm-hmm. And yes, we need to, if we have to pay special attention to girls to encourage them to be in the drum line, we have to build them carts. So that they don't
have... I mean, I had to have a cart. Yes, I'm a boy.
I'm sure a lot of... We're like, you know, like, that's not just for girls, you know. No, but, like, if that truly is the problem, get around it. Like, that... Yeah. I think it's... likewise, if you're programming a season of orchestral works, if you're running an orchestra, and then you program it all, and then you sit with your team, and you're like, okay, let's look at what we've decided to program. And if you notice there are no women, change it. Like, look at why do you think that happens? Mm-hmm. Like, where are you getting your programming ideas? Like, yeah. where are you, what pool are you drawing from, and why, and where is the system breaking down for women? Mm-hmm. And it's our responsibility as people who have succeeded to understand where the system breaks down for women and to address that.
It's interesting. Like, and I look back on my, like, fifth grade upbringing. I mean, my teacher, the person who turned me on to steel drums, who taught me how to play drums in fifth grade, was a woman. Mm-hmm. Her name was Joan Wenzel. She's absolutely my hero, my heroine when it comes to percussion and music. She's the reason, like, she put me on a football field and I just was like, what? Mm-hmm. We can do this? This is crazy. I mean, and there's like 900 people are going to go ape shit whenever we're done. Mm-hmm. And then the football team's going to come out. It's going to be great. Like, this is crazy. And she turned me on to that. She's the reason I'm doing what I'm doing.
That's great.
But even for her, I don't think it was dawning. I mean, there's just so much stuff going on and everybody's flying around and then you got 900 kids being funneled into a gymnasium and everybody's snotting all over the trombone slides and it's like, next thing you know, and band starts the next day. Mm-hmm. And so then you've got this thing and then, but then what that decision, how that process works affects the gender makeup of mm-hmm. an orchestra or an applicant pool at colleges in 2012.
Right.
And then whatever happened the next year in fifth grade affects 2013, you mm-hmm. know, that sort of thing. And I think people get defensive whenever it's like, well, you don't have gender equity. It's like, well, yeah, I know. I don't know. Like, I don't know how, what do you want me to do? Like, right. We didn't apply.
They didn't want to do it.
We opened up the application process as many people as we could. And we got, mm-hmm. but it's like, well, then Aaron Bush comes along and you're like, of course, like, mm-hmm. duh. You know, yeah. Now I know that in 5-6 years, when those girls are graduated, they're in college. Mm-hmm. I know that we're going to have 10 or 12 applications and Aaron's going to be doing this every year. Mm-hmm. Like, I think So's going, I think we're going to do something with them. It's like, we need more of those camps out. And
well, I think that there is a lot of room for affirmative action for young people. Mm-hmm. And I am sort of like, I'm not a big fan of affirmative action. Again, I'm just speaking in terms of gender sure. right now.
Yeah.
There's room for affirmative action in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. but just in terms of gender, I'm not a big fan of it when it comes to dealing with professionals. Like I get very squirrely when like someone asks me to be on a concert and it's like just women. This is a celebration yeah. of female composers. It's like, well, that is a sort of feels like a step backwards for me. In that I feel like my work should be judged against my male peers anyway, for when people are just starting out, there's a lot of room for affirmative action and to give girls, young women, a special nudge mm-hmm. towards this. Cause right now there is like the opposite of that. And they're actively being discouraged because they don't see models for it.
Right.
So if like, okay, you run into the gymnasium, there's 100 kids like snotting over everything. Maybe like the day before you like talk, maybe you talk to some of the girls about what they want to play and why and make sure that, if I was in fifth grade and I was the only girl like trying, like cautiously picking at a drum, I would feel so out of place. I don't think I would have done it.
Yeah.
You know, but if a teacher had been like, oh yeah, I really want you to play the drums, try it. Make sure you get over there and try it. Then it's good.
You know, I would bring in my friend Jihei Jung and I would say, mm-hmm. Jihei is an amazing marimba player. Now you're not going to start playing marimba, but Jihei started playing snare mm-hmm. drum or whatever. And Jihei comes in and just like shreds. And you know, there's a ton of great role models, but it's, I mean, we have the arguments all the time. I feel like they're happening at the collegiate, not that there's not ways we can address stuff in college or even at the professional level. And I think I agree with you. I get a little like, I don't know how to react when somebody's like, you guys need to program X, Y, and Z. It's like, well, I mean, it's just weird as a professional sometimes to parse those out all the time. Mm-hmm. But if we don't ever deal with those problems, will always exist if the feeder to those problems mm-hmm. is still a problem.
Exactly. And I think we need to address the feeder. We need to address the problem at its source.
And so talk about Luna Lab real quick. What's mm-hmm. is there a website and how do folks get tied in with that? How do they, what is it?
Luna Lab is a mentorship program, that I created with composer Ellen Reed, in collaboration with the Kaufman Music Center here mm-hmm. in New York. Mm-hmm. And so our website is, if you go on the Kaufman Music Center website, you can click on Luna Lab. What we do is we accept applications every fall and we pick, a group of students, young, ages 13 to 19, female identifying, non-binary and gender non-conforming individuals are allowed to apply. Mm-hmm. And we connect each of those selected students with a prominent, female identifying mentor in the field. Mm. So they have biweekly Skype lessons. So these are students from all over the country. They meet via Skype every 2 weeks with their mentor. Wow. With the idea, and they spend like from October to May creating a piece. And then in May, we fly them all to New York with one of their parents, and we have a little mini like 4-day festival.
Whoa, that's awesome.
And where they go to rehearsals of their pieces, they work with the players, it culminates in a performance of their work at Merkin Hall here in New York. But along the way, we also give them like this red carpet introduction to the music scene in New York City. So they go on a backstage tour of the Met. Last year we went to see a concert by the New York Phil. They have master classes with like tons of people.
That's amazing.
And what else do we do? Oh, like lots of like networking events and receptions, and we take them to see shows. And so my whole idea is like when they maybe in a couple years they'll move to New York. And this actually happened. We had a student last year who is now a composition student at Manus. She's from Azerbaijan. Actually.
Does that give you a little bit of a heart attack whenever mm-hmm. we have students that I teach and they're like, oh, you should do this thing. And then they're like, I'm going to do the thing you told me to do.
Yeah.
Don't really.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's a terrible idea. Don't do that.
A little bit, but yeah. these girls, like these young women are already like so committed that I feel like, it's really easy for me to give them a little nudge and be like, yeah, you should apply here. So Aaliyah, like she came to New York to be a freshman in college, from Azerbaijan. Amazing. And, now when she walks by the Met, she'll be like, oh, I know what that looks like. I've been in there. I know who works there. Like when she walks by the New York Phil, she's like, oh yeah, I've been backstage at the New York Phil. Like there's a sense of ownership and like belonging.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, a lot of those things can feel shut off to you if you're not, I've been in New York for 12 years and there's places I have never been backstage at the Met or backstage at the New York Phil. I would be terrible. I mean, if I was not playing a concert with them, I would never even there's places she's been, I've never been.
Yeah.
And that's awesome.
And this is what I'm saying. Like I think in general, young women need that little extra push. They need to be made, usually you have to like spend more energy seeking them out because young women are not encouraged to promote themselves in the same way that young men are. And they need that little push in order to feel comfortable. Like it's not a system that is set up for them.
Yeah. Do you think that will ever not be the case?
Yeah, I do. But we're nowhere near that yet. That's why right now I'm a big fan of, again, affirmative action for young people, quotas, organizations that have quotas. I'm a big fan of everyone having to release their gender statistics. Mm-hmm. How many women are you programming? Mm-hmm. We're still at such a beginning phase of this. We need to see it in writing and numbers. And if an orchestra doesn't have, at least 20% female composers, or when it comes to their new work, at least 50-50, there's a problem that needs to be addressed and they should be called out.
Mm-hmm. What do you, I have two final questions.
Mm-hmm.
What one is sort of a bigger, question. I'll start with that. What is an experience for you that, was really bad that you'd never want to repeat again, but you're super glad happened?
This is such a good question. Oh, I think, oh my God. Like, I think
I have a million of them.
It's hard to depict just one. Through. Oh my God. I mean, weird things are popping up for me. It's like, I bombed this piano competition when I was 13 and like just totally bombed. Just got nervous. Mm-hmm. I got psyched out by everyone else and I couldn't handle it. And I went into the car and I started crying and then my sister started crying.
Oh no.
So like everyone in the car is like super upset. I'll never forget that. But, and then another thing, like my interview at Yale, I thought was a complete disaster.
Why?
I thought that I couldn't answer a single question.
Like, what do you mean? Like they were asking you, like, tell me the history of the harpsichord or like those sorts of questions or?
Oh my God. I think I like blocked it out. It was just, they're like, remember they showed you a bunch of scores and they were like with the names covered up and they're like, who wrote this? And one of them was like an early Lutosławski piece, like no boxes, no, nothing that would indicate that it was Lutosławski. It was like from the 50s. And yeah, I was just like, I remember I threw up after that interview. I don't think I'm glad that happened though. I think I'm not answering the question at all. I am glad. I'm really glad I bombed that piano competition though. Because it made me see how ridiculous that aspects of that world were. I mean, it's a very important world that supports a lot of people, but like it was not my world. It was not my scene.
Yeah. While you're thinking of an adult one, I'll tell you, I had two really quick ones. One is I took an orchestra audition when I was an undergrad. Mm-hmm. Because I was, you know, at that time, this was 2003, I think, the only real job paths for a percussionist at that time were you go get your doctorate and you teach mm-hmm. at a university, or you could freelance, but that was sort of like giving up. Like mm-hmm. taking a freelancing career was like, well, I can't do anything else, so I'll just do that, you know. Or you can play in an orchestra. Like Nexus and like chamber music wasn't a thing that you could do for a living. And so I was like, well, I don't have a doctorate yet, so I guess I'll go take an orchestra audition and see what that's like. And, you know, I was like, oh, great, 6 months. I'm going to block off 6 months, work on my excerpts. Well, most people spend, like, years doing just excerpts, you know. And I always hated it, but I thought, well, take my medicine. And I get in there, and Porgy and Bess, do you know that excerpt at all on xylophone? It's just the violin line on xylophone. Whatever. And
oh my god, I could hear that because I remember hearing that in practice rooms.
Yes,
everyone just plays that all the time.
Right. Because it's the like it is the litmus test for whether it's always the first thing. I mean, whatever. I've only taken one, so I can't say. But it was the first thing they asked on the audition. Why? Because if you miss a note, you're done. They don't need to hear the rest of it.
Right.
They don't need to hear any other excerpt on any other instrument.
I'm like having a heart attack.
Yeah. And so I went in there and I was like, and it ends on a C natural, and I just smacked a B natural. But I hit every other note right. I was mm-hmm. like, B natural. And the conductor just looks up and goes, thank you, next. And I was like, the snare drum? He's like, no. And I just sort of packed up my cares and woes and went out and sat on this loading dock.
Yeah.
I'll never forget the loading dock. It was like yellow with this, like this green paint underneath the yellow. It's like this image just burned, like imprinted on my soul. And I just told myself, I was like, I'm never doing this again.
Yeah.
I get one go around on this earth, and I'm not going to spend my time doing this. Mm-hmm. But it meant giving up.
Yeah.
Like letting this sort of like boat drift away that I've been sort of tethered to for a long time. Mm-hmm. It was the first thing I ever like sort of let go of a career path. Mm-hmm. And I had to sort of swallow that pill and move on. I'm glad I did. I'm super glad I did. And I don't regret it, but it sucked.
Yeah.
In the moment. It really sucked. And I forgot my other one. There were two that were really bad. One was in school, I want to say. I can't remember it. Yeah. It slipped my mind. Did you think of one?
Well, I think, I mean, like, my first year in New York, so after grad school, moved to New York, and I thought I had a great plan, which I'm looking back, I can't even remember what that plan was. Like, there was no plan, obviously. But I was like, I know enough people that I'm just going to try to make this work. And if it doesn't work, I'll go back to school. And then that first year was so hard because I remember I had like 7 jobs and still had no money. Like, I was still just run out of money and be like terrified. And I remember walking down the street in Park Slope and just thinking like, this has to change. You know, and I was like, I believe that this will change. And like, but this has to change. And it was just sort of like willing the universe to like, please let something like throw me a bone of some sort. Cause it was like so, so hopeless and so desperately poor. Yeah. But I'm glad, but like, I obviously like that was the right thing to do. So I think just that general feeling of hopelessness was really bad.
Paul Lansky has a really good quote about like, you know, you're blazing, you're a pioneer in some sense. Like you moved to New York during a time. I mean, not that composers have always moved to New York and done a mm-hmm. thing in New York, but the scene that you were sort of, you know, through Mata and things that had come mm-hmm. that came after, like you were sort of planting and tilling the soil early on before anybody else was. And the thing about that, being a pioneer, is you get an ass full of arrows. Like, it hurts, you know? It hurts, you know? There's somebody always, like, you know, you're hacking through new territory, and that feels hopeless sometimes. It feels like there's no, you don't know if there's any money on the other side of that to pay your rent.
Yeah.
You just are hacking. And I found my W-2 after my first year moving to New York. Mm-hmm. It was like $7,200 a year.
Right. Yeah.
I'm like, how the hell, what did I do?
Right. No, I know.
Did I eat? I think I ate. What was I doing? How did you, and, you know, when you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And you just... I think my advice to folks when they get to that stage is just like, well, you don't have a choice.
You just keep going.
You got to work. Just get back to work.
Just keep going, yeah.
Get back to work. It takes a long time to starve to death. You know, water's everywhere. You can get water. Yeah. You know, that's not hard, but you're going to be okay if you just keep working. Final question.
Okay.
What is it like to get nominated for a Grammy? And congratulations, by the way. That's so rad.
It's so great. I'm so happy.
Can you talk about the piece that you wrote? What is it for?
So I wrote this piece called Vespers for Violin. I wrote it for Olivia De Prado. She recorded it on her album Strea, which came out last year on New Focus Records. And it was just a piece I wrote for a friend, like sort of, I wouldn't say for fun, because Olivia is a very serious, dedicated, virtuosic player, and we put a lot of work into that recording. Mm-hmm. But it was just like, it wasn't a commission from a big institution or anything. And then, so they submitted it for the Grammy, and then it was nominated. Like, really, I was so shocked that, I was telling you before we started recording, like, my best friend called me that morning and was like, "You're a Grammy nominee." And I was like, it took me 20 minutes to even understand what he was talking about. Cause I didn't understand. I was like, that can't be possible. This cannot be possible. So I'm just looking forward to it. Like, Du Yun is also nominated in the category for best classical composition. It's myself, Du Yun, Mason Bates, Jake Hagee, and Aaron Kernis, who was my professor at Yale.
Is that weird? Does that feel surreal to be?
It's surreal, but the whole thing is so surreal. It's like, bring it on, you know. Yeah. And Aaron's bringing his kids, who I adore, and I think it's just gonna be fun, and I think it's a chance to like. Put classical music, again, terrible term for what we do, but this sort of non-traditional, non-pop music that we're writing into into the spotlight for a second. And I can't wait. I think it's just going to be fun.
When are they?
February 10th.
February 10th. And you were saying that you're already, like, do you know what your get-up is going to be?
I'm working with the stylist in L.A., who's like a friend of my friend.
It's nicely done. Every time the Grammy nods come out, my wife is like, "So, like, should I go buy a dress?" No, don't go buy a dress.
Yeah,
I don't think you need to buy a dress for the Grammys for a while, dear. It's going to be okay.
Oh, you never know. I mean, I would have bet you $1 million this was not going to happen as you had said that like a month ago.
Well, it's super awesome, and I, like I said, I know you through your. I played your pieces a bunch in school through New Music New Haven. I remember playing melodica on an orchestra piece.
Yes.
I don't remember what the name of the piece was, but
These Worlds and Us.
Yes.
Yes.
That is it. And then you wrote, there's a really great piece for vibraphone and steel drums called Volume. Mm-hmm. But it's so awesome to see what you're doing. And just to sort of, I wish we could cross paths more.
I know. And, hopefully we will.
We need to get the band back together with James and,
yes.
And do like a, we should play Brooklyn Bound.
Colony Vegetable.
there's some stuff though. I think something about a pumpkin. There's some stuff I think I'm glad is not on video. That is perhaps a little salacious. Yeah. Well, that I had to do on stage, and you all encouraged me to do.
Yeah, and you were great.
Right.
Also, remember what you said to Jamie? Like you had this speaking role in one of the pieces. It's like, I don't know, honey. Maybe it's your hairspray. Do you remember?
Yes.
I don't know what it is about you. I think it's your hairspray. And you said that to Jamie on stage.
That was such a surreal. We got credit for that class too.
I know.
Jack V's was our
We've
teacher.
Really played the system.
It's a lesson learned, folks. Play the system. you'll come out on top.
Yeah.
Well, where should folks check you out? And is there any last bit of like you came across something like, people need to go look this artist up because there's somebody you're super jonesed about.
Hmm.
And where can we find you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's finding me is easy. I'm very much like online, and I am on, we can look at my website, missymazzoli.com, for upcoming concerts and recordings and news and stuff. And I'm really jazzed. Actually, Julia Wolf has this premiere happening this week at the New York Phil. Mm-hmm. I don't know if when this podcast will come out, probably not before Thursday, but,
I may be able to get it out before then.
Oh, wow. Well, anyway, I just think she is doing really interesting stuff. And this piece, Fire in My Mouth, is part of a trilogy about workers in America that I think is really fascinating and very timely. So that's kind of, I'm like kind of for the millionth time in my life, like dipping back into her work and into this trilogy in particular.
Cool.
Which is awesome.
She's actually writing us a string quartet. Believe that or not.
What?
Yeah, I'm playing cello, but... Obviously, I'm not playing cello.
Right.
Like Jeff Ziegler plays cello or something, you know, but we're setting up, Jason's playing first violin. Like we're setting up a string quartet, but playing it like four percussionists.
I love that so much.
I love it too. We're terrified because the premiere's in May and...
You got to learn cello before May.
I got to figure out how to play cello to some sort of proficiency. But well, Missy, thank you for your time.
Thank you for talking to me. This is really fun.
And I hope we get to do it again when your next opera comes out. When the Bardo one premieres, I want to sit down and talk again because I want to reread that book and then come see the opera.
We're gonna be like well into middle age by the time this opera comes out. That's true. So we should talk before then.
Let's talk before then.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Missy. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.